ESPN 107.3 presents Wild at Heart, bringing outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, powered by Cowtown USA, Cold Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Trout and Sons, and Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. Now, Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM in the pulse of the Ozarks, beautiful Rolla, Missouri. I'm your host, Tommy Bench. Jerry Cook is my co-host, and John Francis is our radio engineer. Welcome to Wild at Heart. We're red-blooded Americans who remember and cherish our outdoor heritage. We love America and support the Second Amendment. We stand for our national anthem, say please and thank you, and open doors to the ladies. We hunt, fish, trap, shoot, float, camp, and explore in God's country, the Missouri Ozarks, right out your back door and occasionally a few points beyond. Join us each Wednesday at 4 p.m. right here on ESPN 107.3, or catch us Sundays at 8 a.m. or anytime online at ESPN1073.com. Well, to start off the show this week, we got a Missouri muskie hunter and Fred Dearborn. Welcome to the show, Fred.
Thank you, guys.
So, let's get started about this muskie fishing. A lot of people don't realize the muskie opportunities in the state of Missouri.
Yeah, the muskies here in Missouri started back in the 60s with our wonderful conservation department that started stocking one of our lakes, and then it expanded to about five of them in the last several years. The thing about the muskie is it's a northern fish. They were able to adapt and bring those farther south to where they could handle a little better warmer water. And the one thing I like about it is it's a fish that most people never have heard of in the south, and it also gives you an opportunity for a trophy-sized fish. And you're fishing for something that at any time could be a very large fish, could be a state record, or it could be times that you want to throw your rod and reel in the water and give it up.
Get very frustrated. Oh, yes. For sure. So let's start off with what are some of the reservoirs or lakes that you can catch these muskies in?
Well, our first one that was stocked back in the 60s is, of course, Pomme de Terre Lake. And I'm sure a lot of these bass anglers and stuff have caught them. Crappie fishermen have caught them on accident. That was our first lake stock. And then we ventured out to Fellows Lake in 96 and Henry Sever Lake in northern Missouri, as well as Hazel Creek Lake in northern Missouri. We've had some other lakes that were stocked years ago. The stocking program didn't work out too well. The fish weren't responding well in those lakes. And then we tried, we got a bush conservation area, Lake 35, south of St. Louis, very small lake that's producing some big fish as well.
Hmm. I see that there's, just looking at your map there, it's spread out throughout the state pretty well. It's not just all in the northern part or in the southern part, but it seems to be on the perimeter. You know, it's nothing really in the central region of the state itself, though, is there?
No, there's not. The way the conservation's got it set up is they're trying to put them in a lake that anybody can get to within an hour or two, from Kansas City or St. Louis, Springfield area, northern or southern Missouri.
Okay, can I interrupt here for a second, guys?
Go ahead.
All right. For someone like me, who's not, an avid fisherman, I have to say, how would I know if I caught a muskie? What do they look like?
Well, they're long, typically slender. I mean, they very aggressive fish.
Sharp teeth.
Okay.
The ones here in the south will have like a barred color to them, brownish color with bars on them. Things like that.
So how big are we talking about when you said a big fish?
Well, for the southern states, a big fish was going to be an upper 40-inch fish in length.
Wow.
Yes.
That is a big fish. That's huge.
Yes. Now, in the northern range where they are common and they are naturally reproduce up there, you're looking at fish 55 inches, almost up to 60 inches, weighing in excess of 40 pounds.
Wow.
It's a big fish.
That's a big fish.
Especially when you're used to catching crappie or bass or some of the fish we have around here. You catch something like that, you're thinking, what
now,
in the world?
Is that the fish, Fred, that's known as the fish of 1,000 casts?
Well, actually, it was the fish of 10,000 casts.
Okay, okay.
But with our our stocking programs, our catch and release ethics that people are using, we're actually getting that number down. Now we call it a fish of 1,000 casts.
Okay, okay. I thought I had heard that in the past.
Yep. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, and that's probably why I took it on many years ago is I've always bass fished or crappie fished when I was younger, and I got introduced to a muskie fishing probably when I was 13. We were fishing actually in western New York in Chautauqua Lake, which is very common for muskie. I never caught one. I moved to Missouri, and at the age of 21, I spent my first year fishing for these things and never caught one. Almost gave it up. And then it was just like a light switch. I caught one. I started learning about them, you know, how they pattern stuff, what baits they favor at certain times of the year, and have done it since.
I have seen some wooden lures up on Lake Butternut up in
Butternut.
Up in Wisconsin. And boy, I'm telling you what, they can leave some tooth marks in some of those lures.
Oh yeah, I've got several lures. I've got lures that's, you know, they've got the teeth marks in them. Sometimes they'll destroy them, and sometimes they won't. But yeah, Wisconsin, that's a very big state for muskies.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be your – let's talk about something else. We're going to talk about a little education on the muskie and about the reproduction, for example.
Yes. All the lakes in the southern part of the muskie region, Missouri, most of Tennessee, Illinois, things like that. I think there's even some in West Virginia. These fish don't reproduce naturally. So every fish that you catch down here, you're probably looking at – well, when they originally – when they put those in the lake, they're about 12 to 14 inches. They raise them in our fish farm here in Missouri to about that size, and then they'll release so many in each lake, depending on the size of the lake. And then they'll reach about 35, 36 inches in about 3 years. So they grow pretty rapid their first 3 years, feeding mostly on shad and some smaller carp is their main menu, I would say.
Shad and small carp.
Yes.
That's pretty interesting. You know, as much as I've been fishing around here my entire life, I've never caught a muskie.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that's and, you know, we've only got five lakes. I will tell you this. The record was caught back in the early 80s out of Lake of the Ozarks. And a little story on that was actually when they were first stocking Palme de Terre back in the late 60s and they had a truck coming down from Wisconsin with a load of muskies. The aeration system broke down. That was their closest lake. So they dumped them in Lake of the Ozarks. Little chance of survival. And come in 1982 or 1984, a guy caught it. It was just a little over 40 pounds. I think it was 41 pounds and some ounces. And to this day, it still holds the record.
And that's the record. Do you know what the world record muskie is?
There's lots of issues with that. It's not confirmed, but they're saying about 69 pounds many years ago, and that was actually out of Wisconsin.
So a 40 plus pounder is a pretty good size muskie.
You're looking at a mid 50 inch fish, probably late fall when they're packing on the pounds from feeding going into winter.
Right.
So let me ask you this, Fred. What gear would you use to go after these? Because obviously, I wouldn't go after it with a 4 or 6 weight trout fly rod.
No, I wouldn't recommend that. I mean, it's been done. I mean, I've seen lots of photos of crappie fishermen getting these things in. You know, it's just a matter of pure luck on that. But these guys, if you're a bass fisherman, if you've got extra heavy gear in bass equipment, you can use that around here. What I recommend minimum is 65-pound braid on those little reels that you can use for your bass. I recommend a fluorocarbon leader of at least 100 pounds. But I think you can do that. Now, if you want to get serious about it, you're going to have to get into the muskie gear, which, you know, that's can be found online. Lots of stores up north carry them. And you can definitely get into them that way and have a little more security when you actually hook one of those fish and getting it to the net.
It's a little bit different than your fly rod fishing, isn't it, Barry?
Absolutely, absolutely. Although, you know, John knows, I've had a guest on here before. He's from Columbia, Todd Meyer, who fishes for muskie with a 12-weight fly rod and throws 12-inch streamers for
him.
Yep, yeah. I've run into a guy that fly fishes for him. I've taken the last couple of years off. I come back just about a month ago, and actually he's still out there fly fishing on one of the little lakes that I fish, and it's kind of neat to see that.
Would that be Todd Meyer by any chance?
Well, I don't know his name. Yeah. I'm terrible with names, but I know he does fish that little lake.
Yeah,
just,
he's from Columbia, and he really likes to go for muskie on a 12-weight fly rod.
Yeah, that very possibly could be him. He's a nice guy when I talked to him on the dock, but we kind of split our ways and we go find our spots. And
he's a very nice guy and very knowledgeable. And a 12-weight fly rod's a pretty stiff rod.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite rod to use? I'm assuming you probably have different rods you use.
Well, that's the thing on rods is there's so many selections these days.
Just like bass fishing, I'm sure you have different applications for different lures.
My rod is actually a 9-foot extra heavy rod, split grip that I use on with a bait casting reel with 80-pound braid. And the thing I want to talk about on the braid is the reason we use braid is it's no stretch. So you're trying to set that one time that you get to hook into that fish, you don't want any line stretch to go because you've got all those teeth and those bones in that fish's mouth that you're trying to set those hooks into. So if you're going to use mono, your chances of actually getting that hook buried are going to be pretty slim. Mm-hmm.
No, that's exactly right. Same way I am with bass fishing. I use fluorocarbon is what I prefer. And then, like you said, the braid is definitely a good thing to use. But, hey, that's it. That's all segment one we got time for. But we're not done. We're going to talk more about the lures to use, the presentations, the rods, the setup, all that kind of good stuff in segment two. We'll be back with Fred Dearborn. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment is brought to you by Cowtown USA, home of Can-Am ATVs and UTVs located in Cuba, Missouri. If you missed the last segment, one of our sponsors, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, is giving away a $200 cooler. It's the Orca Backpack Podster Cooler. The whole thing is built like a vacuum thermos, and it claims it will keep ice for days. You only have until October 31st to get your name in the drawing for this cooler. So go to their website at livingthedreamland.com or call them at 885-BY-DIRT. That's 885-BY-DIRT. We're back with Fred Dearborn, the muskie slayer.
Thanks for having me again.
You're welcome. Anytime. I love having you on here talking about something that, you know, I love fishing. I love catching fish, especially fish that I've never caught before. It's a challenge, like you said.
Yes.
It was a challenge for you. You just seen it in a magazine. Tell me, I want to catch that fish. And I had this right now. I'm thinking about how I can catch a muskie. But fortunately, I know you, so I think I'll have a little bit of an upper hand. You know, if you listen to the show or all the people listening to the show, go ahead. Let's talk about this.
Well, first off, you know, for you guys that do a lot of bass fishing, these muskies will pretty much set up the same way a bass will in any lake, whether it's on drop offs or if your lake has weed beds or any kind of timber. You know, they kind of just hang out the same way, you know, waiting on prey to come by or just stage up and, you know, just kind of holding out in cover. So you guys, if you guys are a bass fisherman, like I said, you can catch them that way. And I'm sure a lot of you guys have, as we discussed in the last segment. But the one thing about lures for muskies are you can catch them on the big bass baits. And the thing the last few years is some of these bass baits have just exploded in size. These swim baits and stuff, there's some crank baits. They're getting big enough that they can handle a muskie no problem. I've got some here that I've caught muskies on. My fiance's caught muskies on them, and they've held up well. And then you can get into baits. You know, we're looking at anywhere from muskie baits will range from a 4-inch all the way up to 15 inches, weighing in excess of 10 ounces. And the one thing, you got to find out from the fish what they want. And what's notorious about that muskie is they will follow that bait to the lure if they're interested. That'll kind of give you a sign that they're kind of interested, and they may actually eat it on the way into the boat as you're working that bait back. But the other thing is they may follow it, and then you do a big figure eight in the water with your lure. They may chase it around, and then it'll disappear. And then you kind of know that there's fish staged there, so you'll come back at a later time, and hopefully they'll just, you know, go ahead and chomp on that lure when they're ready.
Timing. It's all about timing, isn't it?
Yes, the weather is the biggest thing on them, just like any other fish. That's the number one thing. We kind of use the moon phase as well. We use them on trips when we go in different places, like if we plan a trip 6 months in advance. But just like any other fishing, weather's the number one thing when it comes to musky fishing.
So what do you think dictates when you see a follower coming all the way to the boat, you do the figure eight, and you don't get him to hit or strike, whatever you want to call it? Now, what dictates why you think he did or did not commit to that? Do you think it's the color? Do you think it's because obviously there's 5-6 different lures right here on the table.
Yeah.
So how would you know which one to because like, you know, in bass fishing, it's not like we know exactly what color they're going to hit or what if it's going to be the square bill or the big swim bait or a jerk bait or whatever it is. We don't know that. So what is
well with musky? Here's the first thing I do is when I get on a body of water, if the water's clear, I want to use natural colored baits. If the water's a little dingy, we're going to use a little wild color bait. But I like to match the hatch, you know. Somewhat. I've had pretty good luck with walleye colored or perch colored or shad baits. But if that fish follows, it depends on how aggressive it's fallen behind it. If it's way back behind it and kind of loses interest as it gets closer to the boat, you know, that fish is not really interested. They just wanted to come and see what was coming through the water. And then you may get a fish that's pretty hot and it'd be right up on that bait and it may chase it in that figure eight. And you may do that figure eight up to 7 or 8 times. And she may never hit, or she may disappear, and you do another figure eight, and all of a sudden she just comes up and it just gulfs the bait, and then it's game on. You've got, you know, anywhere from a 30 to 45 inch muskie with 2 foot of line.
That's what I was going to say. You're going to get this much line out of there. So here's another thing. I know muskie are known for their topwater action too, aren't they?
Yes.
Is that just like the bass? It's not something that you would throw at certain times of the year or certain times of the day?
Most of the time it's morning. The southern muskie that are stocked down here are not real favorable for topwater fishing. Most of the fish up north love topwater. I've had fish here follow. I've never had them eat topwater, but I've known some people to take topwater. Hmm. So I'm not a big topwater guy when it comes to muskies down here. Now, when I go up north, they're all over it.
How often do you catch big bass on these?
Usually about every third or fourth trip. Yeah. And I want to mention that my biggest bass was 7.5 pounds, probably 7-8 years ago on a 10-inch bucktail with double 10 blades. Jeez. That was my largest bass.
Let's see that. A 7.5 pounder on a 10-inch bucktail. That's a big of a lure right there.
So describe this, Tommy.
The bucktail?
Yeah.
I'll let him describe it because it's just an inline spinner is basically what it is.
Basically, it's inline spinner. Those blades give off a pulse. And
Colorado blade. Is that a Colorado? Yeah.
Yep. Number 10 blade.
Big blade.
They like the vibration and the water it gives off. And then that skirt behind it as it's going through the water actually just flutters behind those blades as the blades are sucking in water behind them.
Two big treble hooks. Yeah, it's just a giant inline spinner is what it is. You know, with bass fishing, you wouldn't typically throw something that big. But when you do, you're going to catch something really big is what's going to happen. Just like the guy that won the big bass bash. He was throwing a giant 10-inch swim bait.
Yep.
And he didn't care if he only caught one fish all weekend as long as it was the right one and it ended up being.
And I think if I ever fished a bass tournament again, I'm pretty sure I'd have a box of musky lures with me.
Oh, yeah. I've had people comment about my stuff saying, that looks like musky stuff. Because I'm one of them. I'd rather catch big fish. Quality over quantity is my opinion. Yep. I can go out there and catch little fish all day long. I'd rather catch a big one or a few of them. So.
Yep.
Now, let me ask you this. Do muskie favor overcast days or do they like sunny days? Or
The muskies most of the time favor an overcast day. If it's going to be a sunny day, I will target early morning or evenings. In my experience, early mornings, I mean, first light, get on the water and get at it.
So, Fred, you got 6 or 8 lures right here in front of you. Just pick out one or two of them there and describe them in detail to
us. Which one's your favorite? What's your go-to? If you Well, you and I are going fishing tomorrow. Which one is the first one you're going to throw?
Right now, this is the versatile. This is the versatile lure right here. This is a shallow invader. It can be used as a twitch bait, a crank bait, or you could troll it. It's got a real wide rhythm to it. You can twitch this thing, and it goes all over the place.
So let's say what it looks like. It looks like a fish, and it's gold colored, and it looks like what, a stiff body and a real flexible tail.
Yes.
Okay.
And actually, the tails are replaceable just for the fact that the fish can bite them in half.
Right.
Right. And I'm sure it happens a lot, too.
It does happen. You know,
the muskies, thing is big. How long is this? 7 inches?
This one here is about eight.
8 inches?
Okay. We've got one here. I'll just make a quote. These are just the average size muskie lures. They get a lot bigger.
Okay.
But we've got a 15-inch rubber bait here. This is called a bulldog.
A bulldog.
And it's an all-rubber bait.
So it has the real long, flexible tail. The tail itself looks like it's 8 inches long.
Yes.
And then the body, again, it's gold-colored with a black head.
Yep.
These kind of bulbous eyes.
Yep.
And two giant treble hooks on it.
Correct. And you can get these in so many colors.
I love the fact that I would love musky fishing just for the fact that if I accidentally caught a big bass, it would be like a bonus.
Yeah.
You know, that's awesome.
Yep. And speaking of other species of fish, I've actually caught my largest walleye at almost 8 pounds on a musky lure.
Wow.
About 7-8 years ago. It was almost 29 inches, 8.5 pounds.
And where was that at?
That was actually on Fellows Lake.
On Fellows Lake.
Just north of Springfield.
Now, walleye is some of my favorite eating, but is musky a good fish to eat?
Well, we tend to do catch and release on those. Mm-hmm. They say they're a little high in mercury. I don't know if that's true or not.
Make you sicker than a dog. Not a good thing.
But our clubs, the musky clubs, Muskies Incorporated throughout the whole North American and Canada are promoting catch and release. They've done that since the 40s because every fish that you catch, you're looking at a fish that has been stocked, you know, down in the southern region of them.
Right.
So they don't reproduce down here naturally. They've never witnessed it. So when they go to actually in the spawn mode, they'll do the motions, but nothing actually hatches. So that's where the conservation department comes in. They net these fish, they collect the eggs, and they do the hatching themselves up in the hatchery. And they'll let them grow. They do this in March, and they let these guys out about 12, 14 inches in October, November.
Well, that's a lot like we guys who chase brown trout, you know, on a fly rod. We promote catch and release as well.
Yes.
Oh, for sure.
So how old is a 40-pound muskie?
Well, up north, they're going to be probably about 25 years old.
Wow.
Our fish here don't tend to get that big because of the warmer water, so their life expectancy down here is between 10 and 14 years old because they grow so fast. So their body is, you know, is kind of over-exaggerated from growing so fast down here. Plus, they have warmer water, which allows them to grow faster. Up north, they have cooler water where the lakes freeze over and their metabolism slows down.
Hmm.
So they live longer up there. They get bigger up there, but we get bigger fish down here quicker.
Huh. So, Tommy, how old is a typical trophy bass? Like
smallmouth?
Yeah.
Smallmouth, 10 to 12 years. Their life expectancy is about 13 to 15 years. But, you know, a 10-year-old fish, an 18-inch or 19, 20, you know, they're just getting 12, 13, 14 years old. But that's the end of the road for them. You know, I mean, if they live a healthy, healthy life, they may live a couple more years, but that's about it. So that's why I always tell people, I joke around, a small mouth will make you sicker than a dog, like muskie, you know. We don't want them to eat them fish, especially them fish that we love so much and don't produce or reproduce as much. But that flew by, didn't it, Fred?
That flew by.
It flew by. It's already the end of the segment two. And
well, hopefully you'll have me back.
Oh, I'll definitely have you back. I can't wait to have you back and talk more about muskie. I didn't get nearly enough. So anyway, coming up in segment three, we'll be talking
with
outdoor rider Ryan.
So before you do that, just say thanks again to Fred and say his last name too.
Oh, Fred?
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Fred Dearborn, for being on the show, the muskie
hunter. Thank
you
for having me.
You're welcome. It was our pleasure, all our pleasure. Coming up in segment three, we'll be talking with outdoor rider Rylan Malaszewski about DeerCast. You're listening to Wild at Heart. I'm Tommy Bench. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Wow. Welcome back to Wild at Heart. Remember, you can always listen to Wild at Heart anytime you want at our website, ESPN1073.com. Just click Programming and Wild at Heart, or you can tell Alexa on your Amazon Echo to play the Wild at Heart podcast from TuneIn Radio. Don't forget that Living the Dream Outdoor Properties is giving away a really nice Orca Realtree camo backpack cooler just in time for hunting season. It'll keep ice for days. Get your name in the drawing. You only have until October 31st. All you have to do is call 885-BUY-DIRT or go to their website at livingthedreamland.com. Joining us now is Ryan Malaszewski. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Good to be back.
Good to have you back, Ryan. It's always a pleasure speaking with you about what's going on in the outdoors. As much as you're involved, you know, you're a writer as well as involved with many many outfitters and people of all kinds, you know. So, well, you know, first of all, I think we was talking earlier about the waterfowl. Is that something that's really getting good right now?
Yeah, the youth season was kind of hit or miss last weekend. I saw some people that did pretty well and some people didn't do so well. But we're a little bit under 2 weeks now. It'll be November 3rd for the North and Middle Zones opening here. For regular waterfowl, and it's going to be a good one. Everybody I've talked to, especially up north, it's going to be, there's food everywhere. There's water everywhere. We were all struggling here in North and Middle Zone for a while without any water. But we got those big rains at the beginning of October, end of September, beginning of October, that just changed everything. And food everywhere. We get a good cold snap. It's cold up now in the Dakotas. In Canada, they're coming down in waves right now. So I think the opening day of duck season in Missouri is going to be one of the best in years. And this is coming from me and Dan Geyer, who owns Iron Duck Hunting up in Mountain City, Johnny Everhart down in Clinton, who owns the Wilderness Lodge down there. We really do think it's going to be good in the North and Middle Zones. Of course, South Zone's a little different, opens a little later, but for the first part of those zones, I think we're going to be in business.
Well, good. That sounds like great news for all the folks excited about this opening season and getting out there. And, you know, I hear a lot of, I've got some friends that are real big into the waterfowl, and I asked him, matter of fact, I went camping with him here a month or so ago, and I asked him, go ahead.
We're going to stop here just a second. Ryan, are you moving your phone around or something?
No, I'm not.
We're hearing all kinds of noise, like you know, type sounds.
Really? You still hearing it?
Yeah, not right now. No.
No.
Okay. Ask your question again.
I'll try and keep it as.
Okay. All right. Just checking.
No.
Go ahead, Tommy.
I have issues with this microphone, so.
Okay. Go ahead, Tommy. Ask the question again.
Sorry.
What was the question? I don't even remember what I asked.
I know either.
You were saying about your. With the waterfowl guy.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people get excited about, you know, about duck hunting or waterfowl in general, not necessarily just duck hunting. But he told me, he said, I love it. And I said, so are you pretty good at it? He goes, he laughed. He said, not really, but I love it. He said, they fly and I shoot. And if one falls, it's a great day. So
that's right. Yeah, I was a big, I don't want to say anti-waterfowler, but I, you know, up until a few years ago, but I was like, oh, I'm never going to do anything but deer hunt during the fall. Like, I'm deer hunt till I die.
Yeah.
And then I went, and then I was like, okay, this is fun. And now I don't want to say I'm switching, but, you know, I'm definitely putting my days in.
Right. No, that's something I was thinking to myself is I just couldn't imagine me not deer hunting this time of year, but just like you said, once you do it, it's totally a different ball game and it changes your opinion of things.
Well, Milo, I know your old buddy, Bill Cooper, is really big into teal hunting.
Yeah, he is. We actually teal hunted together quite a bit this year, down at, CNR Outfitters and a few places. We did pretty good. They're always hit and miss with the weather in Missouri, but
yeah,
we had quite a few. We had a big flock come in one day. It was about 30 or 40 of them. That's always fun.
Well, I know this time of year, anytime he and I talk, man, it's always about teal.
Yeah, he's ate up with it. I think he likes eating them a lot.
He does too.
He loves it.
Now, how do you know, How do you keep up with all the different species of the teal? Because I was looking the other day, I think Bill gave me a book or whatever. I was looking at the different species and the wing, you know, there's so many different variables. And how in the world do you guys tell up there in the sky flying through? You have literally a few seconds to decide whether it's something you
I have felt the same way, Tommy. I feel like you were kind of in the same boat. Like, I was the big deer hunter. I was like, there's no way you could look up in the sky and see, oh, that's a pintail, that's a mallard, that's a gabball, that's a widgeon, that's a teal, whatever. But I'm going to tell you, after doing it for about 4 years, you can.
You can, yeah.
That's you what see them, and you could, especially the mallards, the drakes, you could see their green head from a mile away. You could tell a widgeon, you could tell a pintail. I mean, and they're up there, and, you know, I always thought it was a bunch of baloney as well, but, man, it's easy to tell once you do it for a while, and you can kind of, you know, you get the cloudy days, it's a little harder, but you get a big, bright bluebird day, you can pick those things out 1,000 feet above you.
I guess that's no different than people that are unfamiliar with fish, for example. They don't know the difference between a smallmouth or a spot or a largemouth, and they're just like, oh, that's a bass, and there's so many different variables. So, yeah, I guess
absolutely.
It makes sense. Well, what's your favorite kind of waterfowl? If you was to pick one to go after, what would be?
Oh, man. As far as taste, I think it's hard to beat a big fat mallard. Just came down from Manitoba.
I would have to agree with that one.
I think it's hard to beat them. As far as sport and shooting them, you know, they're all pretty much the same, especially this time of year. They all just come in waves. And, you know, the pintails are cool.
They're fast, aren't they?
Huh?
Aren't the pintails really fast?
No, I mean, the fastest duck is the canvasback.
Canvasback. That's the one that Al Agnew told me about.
Canvasbacks, they were clocked up to like 65 miles per hour, I believe.
It's about as fast as my cast.
Yeah. The fast ones. I'd say teal. Teal are the most fun just because they're so quick and they're so shifty. And they're the easiest duck to kill as far as I'm concerned because they decoy really easy. They see decoys from far out and they just crash into them.
Well, that's the ones I need to go after with my first time then.
Yeah, they're hard to hit though. Like Dan, my buddy Dan Geyer says, teal and doves, they'll humble you fast.
They certainly will. Hey, Milo, you were talking about, and we agree on the mallard being good eating. What's your favorite recipe for cooking up a good old mallard?
You know, my favorite way to cook them is pretty simple. First of all, I like to leave the skin on. Skin on the breast of the mallards. You get that extra fat and just like an extra crisp to it and kind of protects the meat from drying out. But just a little salt and pepper, and I reverse sear them in a cast iron skillet, just like a steak or, you know, a deer backstrap or whatever. I put them in a cast iron skillet, a little butter, salt and pepper, broil them on high for, you know, depending on the size of the breast, 5 to 10 minutes, and then take them out and then sear them hot and fast. And then you have a nice medium rare duck breast. And it's just as good as a steak or, like I said, a deer backstrap. That's my favorite way to do it. Pretty simple. I do like smoking them too. I do like doing a big, like a whole duck, although it's a pain to pluck them all, but I like smoking a big mallard, and you just get all the flavor in there, especially with the skin on. And, you know, the divers, obviously you want to take the skin off the breast, but all the puddlers, you got to leave the skin on them.
Well, you know, I, as I've mentioned on here before, I grew up in West Kentucky, and as a kid, we did a lot of duck hunting, and basically all we had to deal with was mallards, drakes, canvasback occasionally, but it was actually pretty simple then.
Yeah, I bet it was. Yeah, it's a lot different now. There's all kinds of species, and, you know, there's all kinds of books and recipes and tactics, and I'll tell you this, duck hunting is not a poor man's sport. I'll tell you
it's not. No, absolutely.
That's probably why I'm not doing it.
That's right. I shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah. I stick to the fishing.
Hey, Milo. That'll drain you too, though, Tommy.
Come on, I do.
Hey, Milo, this is John speaking, and you mentioned something about divers and puddlers there. What do you mean by that?
Just a different type of duck. So there's basically two types, or I guess classifications of the types of ducks. So your puddlers are your ducks that are going to feed by skimming on top of the water. So pretty much, you know, all your mallards, your pintails, your teal, widgeon, even your shovelers will be in there, which don't eat those though.
I'm gonna have to get a go and no go list from you. Like, okay,
yeah, this is the good. I mean, they taste like liver.
but honestly, if I ever go or when I go, it'll probably be with either you or Bill or someone that I know I can trust with.
Yeah, so. Agreed. And the divers are just they mainly feed on fish. So it's like your mergansers, your canvasbacks, your redheads, buffleheads. I'm missing a few that we're normally going to see around here, but a wood duck is a puddler. They're not divers. They're good eating.
Yeah, I got wood ducks on the Gasconade.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, you should shoot some here and coming up.
I'll do it. But
their divers are their main diet is fish, so they tend to taste a little more fishy. Honestly, a lot of your divers are probably the ducks you would see getting mounted the most. You know, your redheads and your canvasbacks. So, you know, the canvasback is they call them the king.
And when you say divers, you're talking about literally diving underwater.
Yeah, right. they dive underwater. So
those are the ones I see go underwater, and I'm like, where in the world do they go? And
they're probably buffleheads down where you are. Are they white and black?
I think so. Half the time, I just get a glimpse of them go underwater, and I'm like,
yeah, they're down there for a while.
Yeah, they're down there for a while. It's like, what are they doing? They're just swimming around chasing fish, I guess.
No, yeah, they literally dive. And they'll stay down there for seconds, up to a minute, you know, maybe even more, and they're catching little fish. I was down at Lake of the Ozarks last December, and there was a pair of hooded mergansers, which if you haven't seen those, they're beautiful ducks. But they were on the bank, we were fishing, and there was a bunch of shad on there, and they were diving under, and they'd come up with a shad, and then they go back down, and they're gorging themselves. It was cool to see, though.
That is very cool. Well, Ryan, we're out of time here in the first segment. We're gonna we'll have you right back in just a moment, and with more with Ryan Malaszewski. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart. Stay tuned.
Now back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source for information about what's going on in the world of outdoor recreation and in the Ozarks and points beyond. This segment of our show is brought to you by the Missouri Trappers Association, dedicated to preserving the heritage and skills of trapping. Living the Dream, one of our sponsors, has a giveaway going on right now that you definitely want to be a part of. They're giving away a $200 Orca backpack cooler in camo color, just in time for fall hunting and fishing. You only have until October 28th to enter, so get your name in the drawing now while they're thinking of it. Go to their website at livingthedreamland.com and put your name in their contact form, or give them a call at 885-BUY-DIRT. 885-BUY-DIRT. We're back with Ryan Malaszewski and Ross Schatz. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
How's it going? Glad to be back.
Glad to have you back. So we're talking about deer hunting in particular, and what's going on with the deer hunting, and how has the deer hunting been so far?
For me, it's been so-so. They're starting to move, I think, with the cooler weather. Of course, with deer cast, you're able to pinpoint when to hunt and how to hunt, and you know, we kind of wanted to pick your battles, so to speak. And if you don't have that app downloaded, make sure you download that. I'm working for Drury Outdoors, doing writing for that and being a part of DeerCast. And you see all these big bucks on there. And it's just an invaluable tool.
Oh, it definitely is. It's pretty a phenomenal app for sure. That just, you know, just from what I've seen of it and how deadly accurate it is on, you know, from just what hearing people talk about. You know, they said it was good, supposed to be good or great, and it was. You know, and when it was poor, it was definitely seemed to be the case. So that's the one thing I think that just your average hunter will take away from it more than anything is just that aspect of it.
Absolutely. And a lot of people are weekend warriors, or, you know, they pick and choose their vacation days, and this is going to help you, you know, really by a long shot, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I know I've been telling everyone about it just because of how accurate it is. So, What about down at CNR? What's going on down there with the hunting? Is it any good news coming out of CNR Outfitters?
Well, it's starting to. We, of course, like Milo said, we're starting to see more activity. with the change in the season. You know, it's cooling off, and they're and the bigger bucks are starting to move now. And of course, deer cast is the greatest tool that we can have as a hunter. Of course, it keeps you from wasting some time, and it's just an all around good tool to have.
Well, I agree. You know, I think that it's definitely – I've always had an app of some sort since they invented the deer hunting apps or feeding time apps, so to speak, you know, for fishing. It's just for wildlife in general. But this one is amazingly accurate, and I'm excited. You know, I look at it, and I really take it to heart when I see it says great hunting. I think, well, I got to get out there. Kind of like you said, you know, I don't have every day to hunt, but I want to make the best of the days that I do go. So what do you guys think on just from what you've seen or heard on the activity as far as, because everyone wants to know about the rut, you know, when are these deer going to really start chasing these does and when do they break out of their normal pattern? You know, you got your pattern early season, you got them patterned, you know where they could be coming and going, how they're feeding, and then all of a sudden the does start going in heat and everything changes. Now you never know where that deer might be, but you know if you're around some hot does, you're going to be around some bucks.
So one first thing I'd say is – sorry, Ross. First thing I'd say is the rut in the Midwest or the rut in the Midwest doesn't change. It's the same time year to year. The activity you see changes based on weather, based on, I would argue, moon phases, although that's unscientifically proven. The date that most fawns or all fawns are conceived in the Midwest, and especially Missouri, is November 15th, give or take a few days. So that doesn't change. It's just the intensity, and, you know, if we're hunting the daylight and it's warm, all the activity is going on at night. So, you know, I think it's, you know, I try to keep that in mind.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, see, you know how many people that are hunters do not know that. I mean, I don't know. I didn't know that the rut was literally dictated off a specific date. You know, like you said, that all the fawns were conceived.
Yep.
Give or take around November 15th. You're talking, we'll say, a 3 or 4 day, either way.
3 days, generally, yeah.
Yep. Well, that's pretty interesting because I've heard so many people, they'll make a comment like, oh, we're going to have an early rut this year because of the weather or because, like you said, the moon phase. And, you know, people believe a lot of different things, and I just believe what's right in front of my eyes. So that's all I can count on and what I see out there from, you know, and that's why I'm asking. So Ross, what have you been hearing or what have you been seeing out there, you know, out at CNR?
Well, we're seeing, like Miles said, we're seeing some movement now that the small bucks have been pushing those for about a week probably now. The bigger ones, matter of fact, we've seen a really nice buck pushing a doe today in the midday. So it's happening. You know, it's slowly happening. But I think a lot of it all really depends sometimes on the food source where it's at, and that's where the does are going to go, and that's when the does go, that's where the bucks go.
Right.
So, We're seeing that, you know, along our wood edges, we're getting lots of scrapes now. But the activity is definitely is heating up. This should be a super good weekend for a bow hunter. Mild temperatures, you know, so you can sit in the stands longer, of course. But I think this weekend is going to prove to be a pretty successful at CNR Outfitters. We got some hunters coming in from the country of Mexico to deer hunt with us or bow hunt with us. So we're looking forward to that.
Ross, why don't you tell them about all the food sources and all what you kind of got to lay out down there? I know you mentioned food sources, but I want you to hit on kind of like the specs of the place so everybody can know.
Well, yeah, our lease is an 8,000 acre lease in the Midwest or the central west part of the state next to on the Kansas border. We're about an hour and a half out of south out of Kansas City.
My hometown.
it's a mixture. It's a mixture of corn and beans, and like I said, there's 8,000 acres, and it's a mixture of wood blocks of woods, and then field edges and stuff like that. So the opportunity to see a deer moving on our place is pretty good because of the travel patterns and that they have around them the larger crop field.
So your lease is located in the state of Missouri, though?
Yes, sir.
Okay,
yes.
Well, that's important. You know, for
Highway 71.
Highway 71. Well, that's important, for, like I said, anyone that's wanting to go out there and hunt, if they're from the state of Missouri, for example, they can just buy a residence tag, correct? You know, as far as, you know, I'm assuming that's the way that works. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah, you just have to buy a resident tag, whereas like an out-of-state would have to buy, you know, a non-resident tag, which Missouri's non-resident tags aren't very expensive anyway compared to Kansas or Iowa or Illinois or any of those our bordering states. So what would you say, has there been any big bucks killed out there so far this year? Any what you would call a nice or big buck?
Yeah, we've got one or several up in our Bates County farms, which is a little farther north of Rich Hill. Mm-hmm. A young man killed about 198-inch buck about 3 or 4 miles from one of our big farms up there.
Wow.
And everybody knows that buck probably traveled on our place at one point or another.
Oh, yeah, you know it did.
Their range, yeah. So the genetics are out there. Like I said, Bates County is probably one of Missouri's best-kept secrets. Nobody knows about it, and they've killed a 230-inch buck off there, and then they've killed this 198-inch buck, and then they're there. We just gotta coax them out.
Those are some
we
nice
got a lot of
deer.
Them on camera, Tommy. A lot of 150s, 160s, and there's a couple that are probably going to be bigger than that. So
yeah, those are dandy deer anywhere
out there.
Anywhere you go, 150, 160-inch deer is a heck of a
big deer.
That's a big deer, and it's hard to find them. They don't just come very often, so.
That's right.
That sounds like an amazing place down there, CNR. I've heard so many good things about it from you know, Bill, yourself, from Facebook, just seeing the pictures and hearing all the great stories coming out of there, and I heard there's some great food coming down there as well.
Yeah, my wife is definitely a phenomenal cook.
That's what I hear.
If you book a hunt with us, you're not only going to get a good hunt, but you're going to get a darn good meal and a nice place to sleep. We got a couple houses there that we can accommodate up to 8 hunters at one time. And it's full service food. And it's just a really good, homey atmosphere. My whole family, my son, you know, helps down there. And it's just we're a family oriented outfitter business. And we just like everybody come down and give us a try. We're new, you know. It's a new lease for us.
So yeah,
we need some a little bit of exposure so everybody just knows how nice it really is.
Well, yeah, sounds like a fantastic place, you know. And like you said, the home atmosphere, just a family atmosphere, home cooking. You can't ask for a better atmosphere than that, especially from a deer hunter. So go ahead and give us your contact info. So anyone that wants to come out to CNR Outfitters, they know how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, they can contact us through our website at CNROutfitters.com, or they can contact me at 573-690-7486 if they have any questions. But the website is pretty good. It tells you the dates and the pricing and just an all out good deal.
And Ross, that's CNR Outfitters, the three letters CNR, right?
Yes. Okay. CNR. And that's important because a lot of people may think just the and symbol, CNR. Ross, Milo, thank you both for being on the show. It was a pleasure having you both on.
Yeah, and thank you for having us.
Love to have you back again soon. Let's catch up and updated some deer hunting. So thanks again.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Coming up, we'll be talking about some of the best choices in fishing equipment. I'm Jerry Cook, and this is Wild at Heart. Stick around.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment of our show is brought to you by Colton Steakhouse and Grill in Rolla, where we know what's at stake, and by Trout & Sons, serving you with boats, motors, trailers, and accessories since 1972, located on County Road 1000 in St. James. It's always fun at Trout & Sons. Don't forget that Living the Dream Outdoor Properties is giving away a really nice Orca Realtree Camo Backpack Cooler, just in time for hunting season. It'll keep ice for days. Get your name in the drawing. You only have to
Until October 28th.
Okay, just say it again.
Okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
It'll keep ice for days. Get your name in the drawing. You only have until October 31st.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's written the 28th.
Yeah,
and
sorry.
Oh, I said that earlier.
It's okay. I'll fix it.
Okay.
Want me to do this?
Yeah, do
it. It'll keep ice for days. Get your name in the drawing. You only have until October 31st. All you have to do is call 885-BUY-DIRT or go on their website at livingthedreamland.com. We're going to be talking more about fly fishing equipment here and how one can get into the sport without breaking the bank.
And that's exactly what we want to hear, is not breaking the bank, because we all do that as fishermen, anglers, hunters, anything. If you're any got to do with anything in the outdoors, you know it costs money, but that's what we live our life and that's what we go to work for.
As I always say, anything with the word fun attached to it costs money today.
That's right. It sure does.
But we can get you into fly fishing at a reasonable cost without having to put you into a $1,000 fly rod or a $500 reel. Most people, if you're going to fish strictly around this area of Missouri, a reel is primarily nothing more than an instrument to hold your fly line. Now, you go down to Lake Taneycomo, where they've got some really big trout down there, or down on the White River system down in Arkansas, where, again, they have some big browns, big rainbows, and cutthroat. You're going to need something that's got a decent drag to it.
Speaking of Taneycomo, we was talking to Milo earlier, and Milo and I are planning a trip to go down there. Actually, I'm hoping sooner than later to try to catch some of the big browns. Because, you know, I hear that the inexperienced, you know what I mean, like me going for brown trout, those are usually the people that catch the giants.
Yeah, it seems like it sometimes.
Yeah, like, what the heck? I've been fishing for, not me in particular, but I hear guys say, I've been fishing for these things for 15 years, and I've never caught a lunker. And then I take a guy that's never even caught a brown trout, and he catches a 12-pounder, or –
called beginner's luck.
Luck. There
yeah,
you go.
Beginner's luck.
I want some of that beginner's luck when I go down there. Maybe with one of Jerry Cook's fly rods, too.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah, I can make that happen for
you. Yeah, I need to get one. I want one specifically for smallmouth. But, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about how to get into a fly rod setup that's not going to break the bank. So,
well, and, you're talking about smallmouth and even big browns and Taneycomo, I recommend if a guy's going to use his fly rod for smallmouth fishing and fishing waters like Taneycomo, which is obviously pretty big water, my go-to rod's a 6-weight. Now, some people would argue that. To me, a 4-weight's a perfect trout weight. But if you're going to go for bigger fish like smallmouth, like big browns or big rainbows on waters like Taneycomo or the White River in Arkansas, the North Fork of the White, then my go-to rod's a 6-weight.
6-weight. Well, that's probably what I'll go with, because you got to keep in mind I'm a smallmouth guide.
Right.
So if I'm going to be fishing, it's 95% for smallmouth.
So. And so therefore, I would recommend that you would start with a 6-weight rod. And there are several good rods out there in that weight. Reddington has a really good rod that I believe sells for around $200. You can move up to a little bit better Reddington rod that goes for $300.
So let me ask you a quick question, Jerry.
Yes.
So if someone just hands you a fly rod and says, how good is this rod? What would you be looking at? How would you judge it?
I'd be looking at the action. I would be looking at the guides on it, if they're still in good shape or if they've been worn, because they can actually get grooves cut into them.
So the action, are you looking for something that's flexible or stiff, or how would you judge the action on it?
Depends upon what type of fishing you're going to do. If you're going to be a dry fly fisherman, in other words, fish the surface, then you want something that's a little more limber. You're going to be throwing small dry flies. I had a guy in the shop today. He said he was down on the river, and there was actually a hatch going on, which is sort of uncommon for this time of year. But they were tiny, cream-colored midges. And so, therefore, I personally would be throwing a 3-weight rod or a 4-weight rod and probably a number 20 cream edge or something like that, something really small.
So you'd need a real limber rod for that.
A real limber rod for that. But now if you're going to be throwing streamers or big dry flies, then I would want something in I would go for the 6-weight. There's some people that would go for a 5-weight. I'm
what
personally
about eight?
A 6-weight rod.
Is 8-weight way overboard?
An 8-weight, if I were going to Taneycomo today or down to the White River, I would be taking a 6-weight and an 8-weight because, as you guys well know, I like to throw streamers.
Yeah.
And they require a rod with more backbone to them. But, again, you do not have to take a Sage X-Rod or a Sage Igniter, $850, $895 rod. You can do that with a Reddington that will run $299.95. You can do it with a TFO BVK.
Mm-hmm.
Sage makes a rod for $450. It's mid-level, of course.
Yeah.
That's a really fine rod. And they're obviously...
Does any of those that you just mentioned have a lifetime warranty?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they all have a lifetime warranty.
They all do. So if I can go out there and I'm floating along the river and it gets hung up in a brush and it breaks the tip, I'll get a new rod.
Well, if you handle that rod properly, it's not going to break the tip anyway.
Right. But, I mean, what if it's an accident?
Well, if it's an accident, they will fix that rod. Now, there's typically a warranty fee involved. But, you know... that's to be expected. It's almost in any type of fishing equipment, there's a warranty fee involved.
How much is that warranty fee?
Well, Sage on their current models is $25. Now, you get into the discontinued models, it goes to $75. You go into what they call their classic models, which have been discontinued for 25 years, then you're looking at $125.
But $25 is nothing when you're spending... No. Several hundred dollars on a rod.
Yeah, you're talking about a $400 to $900 rod, and you pay $25 to get a new rod.
Well, usually they replace the section that's broken and just fit a new section to it, and it has to be fitted to it.
Fine with me. Yeah. As long as I got a new rod again.
Right.
Because, you know, my current rod I told you was broke, and I thought, well, maybe I can get a new one. I don't know. I don't even remember what brand it was. I'm not that particular in it. Yeah. I just asked the guy at the fly shop, you know, his recommendation. I think it's an 8-weight. That's the reason why I was bringing that up.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it is.
Well, an 8-weight's going to give you enough backbone typically to throw big streamers and to handle bigger fish.
I'll have to bring it in here and show it to you.
Yeah, I'd be happy to take a look at it for you.
So what's going to be the difference between a $200 rod and an $800 rod?
Well, an $800 rod typically
$600.
Yeah.
Typically, you're going to have more accuracy with it's going to be newer technology, different graphite composition. You're going to have more accuracy. You're going to have less tip bounce. You have to be really an experienced fly fisherman to be able to know the difference.
That makes sense, yeah.
But once you get into the sport and you really start learning it, you're going to progress up the ladder just like you do with your bass rods.
Right, yeah. I don't go and buy the $30 combos at Walmart anymore.
Right.
But, you know, there's people – There's anglers out there that don't go fishing that don't have the love and passion that you and I do.
Right.
So like if John wanted to go or someone that just said, well, I don't want to spend hundreds of dollars, but I want something I can go out and fish with my kids or with my whoever, you know. And so there are people that just go to Walmart and buy a cheap combo and they think, well, that's what I'm going to buy because I use it 2 times a year, and they sit in the garage, and then I might. You know, if I lose it, I lost $30.
Yeah, so. But there's a big difference in how that rod casts.
Oh,
there really is.
Oh, no, I know there is. There's
and
a
it's
huge
not
difference.
Just a sales talk, okay? There is a big difference. In
not just the way it casts, the sensitivity on the bite when you feel it.
Exactly.
The pressure it holds on to it when you're fighting a fish, and allows it to, you know, that's one thing. Everyone knows I love Falcon rods. That's not fly rods, but I will tell you, their cranking rod is phenomenal, and it's just a great rod.
Because of tip sensitivity,
yeah,
for
absolutely.
One thing.
Look at this. We've already burned up a whole other segment Just like that. We have so much fun on this show. You guys just don't want to miss it. You've got to stick around for our next show because we just full of excitement.
We've just scratched the surface.
That's it. But coming up in our next segment, we'll hear from the president of the Mizzou Fishing Club, David Goddard. Stick around. You won't want to miss it. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source of information about the Ozarks and a few points beyond. This segment is brought to you by Guard Truck and Equipment and the Outdoor Superstore, your Husqvarna dealer located on the North Outer Road in St. James. On the line with us is David Goddard, the president of Mizzou Fishing Club. Welcome to Wild at Heart, David.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Going good. How has things been going for the Mizzou fishing team this
year?
Well,
it's been going pretty well. Fall season is pretty well wrapped up for us. We have a couple club tournaments left, but other than that, we're all done with big tournaments for the year.
Well, let's just start with a little history. How did it form, and how long has it been around? You know, that kind of sort of thing. Because the fishing, college fishing is fairly new. When I say fairly new, I mean it wasn't around 20 years ago. What can you say about that? Because I think it's an awesome idea, and it's great for the sport, and I love seeing. The younger generation still doing the things that we love to do. You know, that some of us older guys, like myself and Jerry, like to do. So
yeah, absolutely. We started around 15 years ago, and obviously I was not going to school here then. But we started about 15 years ago with just it was just four guys, one boat and four guys.
One boat
and. Now we've grown to about 30 members. We have about 30 members this semester. I'd say around 15 boats. And usually, so a lot of collegiate teams that you see compete, like, you know, the big schools, Northern Alabama, Bethel, even Kentucky, they have university funded programs. Right. And here at Mizzou, we're actually just a club sport. So we pay for a lot of our own stuff. We supply all of our own boats and things like that. And sponsors obviously pay for a lot of that as well.
Yeah, that helps. Definitely having lots of sponsorship. And that's something else, you know, I'm sure it's just like anything else. The better you do or the more you're exposed, the better your sponsorship opportunities become.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In the couple years that I've been a part of the club, I've seen our sponsorship list grow a lot. And a lot of that has to do with us being successful. I mean, we have two teams going that qualified for nationals in 2018, or for the 2018 nationals, which are held in 2019. But
right,
and that's on the Potomac River in Washington, Washington D.C. So we're excited for that. And then, of course, we have our full spring schedule coming up this year, and I think we go to Kentucky Lake, Cumberland, the Mississippi River at Wabasha. And then Lake of the Ozarks again. So a lot of guys are really looking forward to that. And that's just the FLW. We don't even know the BASS schedule yet. So,
oh, wow. So
it keeps you hopping, let me tell you.
Oh, for sure. Sounds like it does. I mean, that sounds like it'd be pretty difficult to sometimes schedule, you know, your school and then their fishing. And I know what it's like being a fisherman and fishing all the time. But, you know, one thing that I was thinking about is how does the recruiting go as far as, like, how do you get people to – want to go to, you know, be in the club, the Mizzou Bass Fishing Club? Is it just only, college collegiates that are already there, or is it something that you can try to draw people in? I mean, how would you even go about that? Because, you know, for example, basketball or football, you know, they have scholarships and there's recruiters
right.
who go around and watch all these big games, state championships, whatnot. You know, how does that work for the fishing side of it?
So what we did is, in the past, we haven't done a whole lot of recruitment, so to speak, but what brings a lot of kids in is that Mizzou is a good academic program, and they send a lot of people off to get, you know, good full-time jobs. So they want to come to the university for that, but they also like to bass fish. So what we mainly try to do is we mainly try to make sure that our name is out there at the university and that people know that if they want to fish collegiate tournaments, we're here to facilitate that. And this year, we're actually planning on going to a couple high school events in the spring just to get our name out there a little bit more and hopefully help grow the team some more. And then lastly, like we do events on campus, and we also well, not really events. We go to like club sports events on campus where all the club sports are at. And then we're looking at doing hosting a tournament this coming spring on Lake of the Ozarks to help raise money for our club, and then also to get our name out there some more.
That's all. That's great.
You know, David, I grew up in Paducah, Kentucky, and pretty much on Kentucky Lake, and I know that the program at University of Kentucky is quite popular there. In fact, even fly fishing is very popular there. One of my old classmates from high school taught fly fishing at UK.
That's awesome. Maybe I should have went to Kentucky, huh?
No, I like the fact you're at Mizzou. I like that.
I have to agree. You know, I actually went down to Table Rock this weekend, and one of the coolest, and not that you can do this at Kentucky Lake as well.
Oh, yeah.
But we caught three keepers in, you know, the first 2 hours of the morning or so, and we weren't fishing a tournament or anything. But the three keepers that I caught, one of them was a nice like 16-inch smallmouth, and then a largemouth and a spotted bass. It's pretty neat just because there's not a lot of places in the world you can do that on one body of water.
No, there's not, especially the smallmouth. Those smallmouth, of course, you know I love them, and they're super special as far as, you know, where you can find them and where they thrive at. They don't just thrive anywhere.
I totally agree. I would have to say I would rather fish for smallmouth than any other species of fish I've ever caught.
Yep, I like the way you think, because that's the way I think too.
Well, next to brown trout anyway, you know.
Oh, I don't know.
You know, I don't mind trout fishing too much. There's something special about getting out there when the water's hard in the winter and fishing for big browns with a fly rod. I have to say I enjoy that quite a bit as well.
Absolutely. You're a man after my heart, man.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, there's a lot of young kids that I deal with or speak with all the time that love fishing, and they would love to know what opportunities they can or what avenues, you know, because so many kids are like, I want to be a pro fisher when I grow up. Well, you know, that's what a lot of us thought too. And then,
exactly.
You know, I ended up becoming a guide instead. But either way, it was one of them deals, you know, to where they have a love and a passion for it. And I really think that, and I know from where I grew up, Mizzou has been like, that's their hometown. You stay loyal to your state and to your town.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
And then it's kind of what you do is you try to stay in your, you know, in your hometown state when you go to college. But, you know, I'm just saying, I think it'd be a good avenue to get some kids more involved in fishing around the state of Missouri.
I totally agree. And you know, I played baseball in college, and I was always given the opportunity to put my skills out there and show scouts and coaches, and whether they be professional or collegiate scouts when I was in high school, what I could do. And in fishing, you know, the high school ranks are growing, absolutely. But like you said, a lot of kids don't really know the avenues and the pathways that are out there for them to pursue a career in the fishing industry. And you becoming a guide, I mean, that I think that's awesome. That's something that I would aspire to do just because you get to fish for a living. And I know it's not as much fun as fishing the elites maybe, but still, it's better than going to work every day.
It's better than going to work every day. And sometimes, you know, a guide is not what everyone thinks that it really truly is, because there's times when it seems like it's a lot harder work than doing a real job, because you have people that can't cast, they can't set the hook, they're getting bit, but you're like, set the hook, and what am I doing wrong?
Right.
You know, there's so many variables to go along with it, but you know, other than that, though, it's a pretty good deal. You know, it's fun to be out there and see the excitement on their face. But, you know, that's the thing. You know, I love to fish, and I love to see other people catch fish, and kind of like you.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about this. How many high schools do you know? Like, as far as the high school fishing clubs, how big mm-hmm. is that? I mean, because I've heard of a few, like around our state in particular. They have championships as well, right? Do you ever attend those events?
I know that in southern Missouri, it's a lot bigger than it is up north. I'm actually from Bowling Green. If you know where that is,
yep.
You and the 10
yep.
people that live there are in on that secret.
But yeah.
It's pretty small. We're a small community. We don't have a fishing team. I know that a lot of schools up north don't, but in Illinois especially, it's really big. I played college baseball in Illinois, and high school fishing was huge. They'd have tournaments that were high school tournaments, and they'd have 400 kids. So it's really big in Illinois. It's really big in, I would say Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, a lot of those states like that. But in Missouri, for whatever reason, it's kind of consolidated in the southern part of the state. That could be because of the Ozark, you know, the Ozark lakes that are down right there. And, you know, I do have to say I fished Mark Twain a lot. And if you could tell me I could fish one day on Lake of the Ozarks or a week on Mark Twain, I'd take my one day on Lake of the Ozarks.
Yeah.
So it's just a big, it's a changing demographic, and it's something that I would like to see grow a lot more, because these kids, they could, you know, they deserve the same opportunity that everybody else gets to pursue that high school fishing thing. And I really think that, even if you don't fish in high school, I mean, I didn't fish in high school competitively. I just fished for fun. And, you know, coming to Mizzou and fishing in college really opened my eyes to the whole world of competitive bass fishing. And it's really fun. If fishing is something that you enjoy, and assuming you're at least a little bit competitive, it's a fun thing to do. And even if you don't want to look at it as a future career, if you just want to do it as something to keep your nose out of trouble or whatever it may be, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing. I don't know too many anglers out there that are going to bars or, you know, spending their weekends doing stuff like that, you know, or strip clubs.
They don't have any money left.
They don't, right? That's exactly right. You invest all your money in your tackle and your line and your rods and reels. We were just talking about that and expenses. Right. And so, yeah, that's exactly a great thing.
I got on the phone this evening before I got on the phone with you guys. I was over at my tournament partner's place repacking his bearings on his trailer. So
yeah, it's always something. It's always something with fishing. But we still got a ton of stuff to talk about, David. I was wanting to talk to you. Well, I'll just talk about it on the next segment. But we got to take a break here, and we got more to talk about. And it's been great so far. So
okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, stay tuned. We'll be back with more from David Goddard in just 3 minutes. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back. I'm Tommy Bench, and you're listening to Wild at Heart. This segment of our show is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. It's not just land, it's a lifestyle, and we live it. And Living the Dream is giving away a great cooler this fall. It's an Orca Realtree backpack cooler in camo color, a $200 value. This thing claims it will keep ice for days. It's a great looking cooler, and all you have to do is get your name in is to go to livingthedreamland.com or call 885-BUY-DIRT. You only have till the end of October, so do it now while you're thinking about it. Well, we're back with David Goddard with Mizzou Fishing. Welcome back, David.
Hey, guys.
So here's one thing I was thinking about. May or may not, I don't know if this is the case. Do you know of any anglers that have come from the high school or collegiate ranks, meaning they fished competitively in the college ranks or in high school ranks, that has become, you know, that has progressed to, we'll say, FLW or the Elite Series or anything like that? I know there's a lot of young anglers. I don't know if they just – I know they started somewhere, but there's a lot of great anglers out there.
Yeah, there's actually a whole lot of guys that have moved through the college ranks and now fish the Elite Series or the FLWs, or at least the Costas and the Opens.
Yeah.
But if you watched the Bassmaster bracket, or not the bracket, the Open Championship this weekend, if you paid attention to any of that, it was on Table Rock Lake, and there was actually 5 guys in it that had fished in college. So 5 out of 28, that's a pretty decent little chunk.
Yeah, it is.
And also, I know there's a lot of guys that do the same thing in FLW. You know, they do really well coming out of college. The biggest thing I think that college gives guys is it doesn't necessarily give them a way to make a lot of money doesn't give them a way to win a lot of boats or prizes or anything like that, but it gives them a platform to showcase what they can do as an angler. And in the past, a lot of people weren't really given that opportunity before college. You know, and you may have seen this some fishing tournaments and stuff, Tommy, is when you fished those tournaments, there wasn't TV coverage. There wasn't, all the results getting shared on 3 or 4 social media platforms. It's just now these guys that can do it and can perform well are given a place that they can showcase their skills. And I think that's the biggest thing that collegiate fishing does.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you just hit the nail on the head right there by talking about the exposure that it gets that it didn't get, you know, right. Years ago.
Exactly. Exactly right.
That's great, though. You know, I love it. Just it really makes my heart smile to see the younger generation still have an interest in the outdoors. You know, there's so many kids, and I'll admit, including my own, that I'll see with a tablet or an iPad or a phone or whatever it is right in front of their face. And I'm just as guilty because I almost live my life on that phone as far as business and whatnot. But I mean, I use it as a tool, and it just seems like phones are becoming tablets, just electronics in general, are overtaking our younger generation and not putting them aside, you know. So,
you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, and since I know my girlfriend's not listening to this, I'll go ahead and tell you this. But I can honestly say I've never went fishing in the last 3 years that I've been here at Mizzou in college and had phone service. Whether I be fishing a city pond in St. Louis or up north in Canada, I haven't ever had phone service one time.
Yeah, and that's funny you mentioned that, because I've heard a lot of complaining about why I didn't answer my phone or text back. And I'm like, when you're on that river, you're in the lowest lying place of the country or the land, and you don't have service the majority of the time. If you do, it's in and out real quick.
You know, right. David, you're talking about television coverage earlier. Again, I kind of grew up on Kentucky Lake, and I have actually watched on TV some collegiate tournaments on Kentucky Lake. And, it's like, wow, man, you know, just to think, when I was a kid, man, I fished that area a lot, and nobody ever thought about telecasting it then.
Mm-hmm. It's blown up for sure.
So. I'll be hopefully on TV on Kentucky Lake March 10th, I believe, this coming year. So,
is that?
But you're totally right. It's crazy how big almost that it's gotten, and how much interest it gets. I mean, if you watch Bassmaster Live or whatever, you know, I'm a college kid, so I can tune in at Thursday or Friday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you'll assume that everybody else is working, but I tell you what, there'd be 10,000 other people watching.
Oh, yeah. And John, you know who John Nipradny is, don't you?
Yeah.
I took him on the river. He's big into the college and high school ranks fishing. He's really pushing that hard, and it's good. It's a good thing, like I said. And like you mentioned, you know, it takes a lot. You spend all your money on it, but it's an addicting sport, man. It's so fun to do, and it keeps you out of trouble. Especially, you know, as parents, you know, you're thinking if you can get your kid into doing something like fishing rather than a lot of the other things that are out there these days.
Absolutely.
I definitely put fishing right there towards the top.
Yeah, we were joking off the air there, David. I tell people that come into my shop. Looking at fly fishing gear, and they've got their kids with them. I say, hey, you know, get your kids into fly fishing. They'll never have money for drugs or alcohol.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
Another great thing that I see about fishing is that it doesn't, it's not just a specific group of people. Not everybody can play collegiate sports. Not everybody can play high school sports.
Right.
But just about everybody can fish.
Absolutely.
And with a little bit of practice, just about everybody can do all right with it. So,
exactly.
It's another thing. It's another thing that I think is kind of great about the sport, because anyone can do it. You can get beat by a 12-year-old girl tomorrow, and you'll just be like, "Dang, she whipped my tail."
Yeah.
But in other sports, that's not really the way that it goes.
Well, you're exactly right, David. There's a one of the pros, one of the elite guys. I don't remember if it was Rick Klein or. Gee, man, I don't know if it's Gerald Swindle or who it was, but one of them talked about, it may have been Mark Rose, so I don't remember now, but I just remember one of them speaking and making the comment, fishing does not discriminate against age. It doesn't matter if you're 5 or 85. You know, if you can cast a line out there, the fish doesn't know that it's an 85-year-old man or a 5. You know what I mean? They just know on what they see.
Exactly.
And it's you're right. You're exactly right on that, and it's an amazing sport. So,
yep, I totally agree.
What are some other things you guys are? So let's get back to how your season went. We were talking about, you said there was a few of them that's going to be in the championship. And how does that format work in general, like throughout the season? You know, how does it work? Is it like a series just like FLW has or the?
So the way that it works is there's for FLW, there's an open every year that every team in the country is invited to fish. And then there's three regional tournaments. I believe they're called regions. But so we are obviously in the central region, and you have to place in the top 10 of one of those events to qualify for the national championship. Now, if there's over 100 boats in one of those events, for every 10 boats over 100, they send another team to nationals. So let's say there's 120 boats, so they'll send 12 people to the nationals, the top 12 instead of the top 10.
And what happens?
And then,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was thinking ahead, I guess, on the nationals. You know, what kind of stage is that as far as, do you guys win a boat for the team or is it an individual basis or how does that work?
So the way that nationals works is two guys fish together as a team, right? And then the winning team, they fish head to head at the end for the single national champion. And then they believe they win a boat. And then, you know, for the top, I think nationals pays out the top 10 places or top 15 places, and the payouts are a lot larger. And the thing about these college tournaments is the payouts aren't huge. We're not talking, you know, BFL or Open or Costa payouts, but the entry fee for us is nothing through FLW.
As it should be, you know, at the college level.
Right. Right. It should be, but still, like, it's pretty cool that you can pay nothing and win something.
Exactly.
But for BASS, it works very similarly. There's, I believe, 6 tournaments, which any team can go to. There's no regions, but any team can go to any of the 6 tournaments. A lot of those are kind of impossible for us to go to because, you know, last year there was one in Toledo Bend. So we were able to send one team down there, but that was the one that was closest. Aside from Cherokee, there was one on Lake Cherokee, but it was the same week as finals week. So no one on our team was able to go. But then there's also a state qualifier in every state for BASS, and the winner of that state qualifier goes to the BASS nationals. Me and my partner actually got 5th in that last year. It was pretty tough. It was on Table Rock, and every day of practice we ran new water every single day and caught anywhere from 17 to 14-ish pounds. And then tournament day came and we caught 13.5 and got 5th, and it only took 14 to win.
Wow.
So it was kind of it's kind of biting the bullet, but the lake came up 5 foot in that night. So, or in that, the last day of practice in the evening. So
that's still pretty good. You know, fifth place and being just ounces away
from good. That. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey David, we only have about a minute left here, but I'm looking at your Skype picture and it's you with this gigantic fish. What kind of fish is that?
How big is it? Largemouth.
I don't know that I'd say quite gigantic, but it's a good one. It was a 5.5. That was at the FLW National Qualifier on Lake of the Ozarks about a month ago.
You guys ever fish the Big Bass Bash?
Yeah, we sent around 16 guys down there, I think. We had 16 guys go from the team that fished the bash.
Cool. They ever do any good? Any take a check?
We had one guy got 5th place in one of the time slots, and then we had another guy weigh in 2, and one guy weighed in 1, but they weren't they were in the 20s somewhere on their time slot.
It doesn't matter. That's still pretty good.
We cashed 2 checks.
There was 4,800 entries in this last Big Bass Bash. You know, you're going against 5,000 other anglers. So, hey, yep. David, man, we had a great time, and just time flew on by, and you're full of information, and it was a pleasure having you on the show. And again,
thanks for having me.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
Thanks. We appreciate having you on. You're so full of information, and we'll have to have you on again.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Thank you, sir. You have
take
a good
easy,
one.
Guys.
You too. Wild at Heart is heard every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 and Sunday morning from 8 to 10. The show is produced in the studios of ESPN 107.3 in Raleigh and engineered by John Francis. We'd like to thank our guests today, Ryan Malaszewski, Ross Schatz, David Goddard, and Fred Dearborn, the Musky Slayer. Don't forget, you can always listen to a podcast of this show. Just go to our website at ESPN1073.com. Click Programming and Wild at Heart. I'm Tommy Bench.
And I'm Jerry Cook.
Thanks for joining us.